When we talk about Jesus being the fulfillment of the Old Testament, we're usually talking about a very sort of linear concept. That is, we're talking about a clear prophecy that says, you know, the Messiah will do this, and then we see Jesus do what was promised. And so, for example, in Zechariah 9:9, it makes the promise to the daughters of Jerusalem that the king would come in justice, bringing salvation, riding on a donkey. And so when Jesus triumphantly enters Jerusalem riding on a donkey, we can point to that and say, well, there, Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament. But that's not the only way we see Jesus fulfilling the Old Testament. And this is where biblical theology, right, seeing that grand story of Scripture, that single grand story of Scripture, is very helpful. The writers of the Gospels, especially Matthew, all of them to some extent, but especially Matthew, often picture Jesus as fulfilling the Old Testament without it being a specific promise or prophecy found there. So let me give you an example of what I mean. As you recall, when the wise men visited Jerusalem, right, seeking that newborn king, the wicked man who would be king, Herod the Great, was quite disturbed with the news and attempted to have that new child murdered. Now, all Herod knew was the boy was born in Bethlehem, and so here's what Matthew's gospel tells us. It'll be a bit of a long reading for a video like this, but stick with me. Matthew 2, starting at verse 8, he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search diligently for the young child, and when you have found him, bring me word again that I may come and worship him also." And when they heard the king, they departed, and lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise and take the young child and his mother and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him." So Herod's plan was clearly to have the wise men go to Bethlehem and come back and tell him where to find the child Jesus so I can worship him. But worship was not what he had planned. He had murder on his mind. So God gave the wise men a dream that they would not return to Herod, and he also gave Joseph a dream to take the family into Egypt and escape. Now, Matthew's told us this story, and then as it sort of continues to unfold, he wants to connect some dots for us. You ready? Back to the story at verse 14. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, "In Ramah there was a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and would not be comforted because they are not." That's just a terrible scene. What a horrific world Jesus was born into. The family just barely has time to escape to Egypt while the unsuspecting families in Jerusalem have babies ripped from their arms and murdered by Herod's soldiers. But within that scene, Matthew connects some dots to the Old Testament for us. And it's not that kind of nice, simple, linear fulfillment of prophecy, but he says it's fulfillment nonetheless. Did you catch them? The first one's in verse 15. The family of Jesus escaped to Egypt, and it set up a fulfillment of the Lord's words, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." Now, let's look to the Old Testament and see what it is Matthew is quoting. He assumes we'll be able to find it. He tells us it was a prophet, but he doesn't tell us which one. And sure enough, we see the reference in the prophet Hosea. Hosea 11, verse 1. "I loved him and called my son out of Egypt." It would just be so easy if that was all it said. But actually, let's get a little more context. Hosea 11, we'll start at the beginning of the verse and go through verse 3. "When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. As they called them, so they went from them. They sacrificed unto Balaam and burned incense unto graven images. I taught Ephraim also to go, taking them by their arms, but they knew not that I healed them." That son that Hosea is talking about is the nation of Israel. The nation is referred to as God's son several times in the Old Testament. In fact, we don't want the son in Hosea 11 to be Jesus, because verse 2 and 3 shows the complaint of this son is that he's a straying son. He's an idolatrous son. He's indifferent to God's guidance and ignorant of God's leadership. Hosea is not talking about a good son at all. God is saying there in Hosea, "I loved my son Israel. I brought him out of Egypt, but he failed. Israel went astray. My son Israel rejected my commands and fell into temptation. Didn't trust I would provide. Went and worshiped other gods." Now, there's not really even a promise or a prophecy in that verse. So why would Matthew say, see Hosea 11, 1? Jesus fulfilled that. Well, it seems that the answer is he's drawing a parallel between the life of God's son, Jesus, and the history of God's people, Israel. God saved Israel from certain death of that famine by moving them and protecting them in Egypt. And then he brought them out of Egypt to serve him. Right, that's what he said. I loved Israel. Out of Egypt, I've called my son, but they failed. Now, hit pause on that for just a second. Not literally pause on the video. Just pause on that thought. And let's look at the other passage that Matthew's making an allusion to. When Herod murdered those infants in Bethlehem, Matthew said this: "Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, in Ramah was there a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and would not be comforted because they are not." So this time, Matthew gives us the prophet to narrow down the quote that he's giving. It's Jeremiah, specifically the time Jeremiah is recording a lament about the nation being judged for their sin and captives being carried away to Babylon, children being taken from their mother and carried away. And so he pictures in this lament Rachel symbolically as the mother of all Israel's children weeping that they'd been taken away. Here's Jeremiah's quote from Jeremiah 31, verses 15 through 17. "Thus saith the Lord, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping, Rachel weeping for her children, refused to be comforted for her children, because they were not." Now that's some tear-jerking words, if there ever were any. But then it says, "Thus saith the Lord, refrain thy voice from weeping, and thine eyes from tears, for thy work shall be rewarded, saith the Lord, and they shall come again from the land of the enemy. And there is hope in thine end, saith the Lord, that thy children shall come again to their own border." So Rachel is weeping, but verse 17 says there's hope in the end. God's not finished with this story. And then Matthew quotes Jeremiah, saying there are more missing children than there's the heartbreaking sound of mothers weeping, but there's hope in the end. So again, Matthew isn't saying Jeremiah made a promise and Jesus fulfilled that promise here. He's simply making a parallel of the life of Jesus and the story of the Old Testament. It seems like Matthew is convinced that everything in the Bible is to be understood Christologically. Everything is made clear in the light of Jesus. Even the horrific murder of infants by a wicked King Herod, the story is not going to end like this, Matthew says. God has a plan for blessing and restoration, even in the heartache of that current situation. Now, if we keep our eyes open to this, you know, we'll see this parallel continue in the story throughout the Gospels. When God brought Israel out of Egypt, just going back to that thought, when he brought Israel out of Egypt, they escaped through the Red Sea, right? Paul even referred to it as a kind of baptism in 1 Corinthians 10. When you follow Matthew's gospel, the next part of the story sees Jesus coming to be baptized by John the Baptist, right? He comes out of Egypt and goes through the water, just like Israel did. And God speaks again. This time it's not a complaint like it was in Hosea 11:1, right, where I loved Israel and called my son out of Egypt, but they failed. After the baptism of Jesus, the voice of God speaks from heaven and says, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. So Jesus is mirroring the history of Israel, but he's not going to fail. You know, they were brought through the Red Sea and they failed to trust the promise and provision of God. And so they ended up in the wilderness for 40 years. Numbers and Deuteronomy tell the story of their trials and their temptations, their repeated failures out in the wilderness. Well, Matthew, as you continue the gospel, in Matthew 4, it shows Jesus after his baptism being led by the Spirit into the wilderness for 40 years. Days, not 40 years, but it was 40 days in the wilderness, during which he's tempted by Satan and overcomes each type of temptation that Israel had faced and failed. It seems so evident that Jesus is mirroring the story of the history of the nation that even when he overcomes temptation, he's always doing it by saying, it is written, it is written, it is written. And when you look up those references, you know where you find them? You find them in that covenant book of Deuteronomy of Israel in the wilderness, correcting Israel's failures, right? So Satan says, why don't you turn these stones into bread? Jesus' answer with a reference to it is written and talks about manna in Deuteronomy, saying what Israel should have said, which is essentially, if the Father wants me to have bread, he'll give me bread. Each time the words from Jesus are what Israel should have done, right? Don't tempt the Lord your God. God alone is worthy of worship. We see these parallels between the life of Jesus and the history of Israel. And the point seems to be that he is succeeding everywhere that Israel failed. They owed God a life of righteousness, and the life of Jesus is the only one that actually fulfills that debt. In practical terms, this should make us just thrilled when we read the gospel story, but more importantly, I would hope it would help us to love Jesus more. He's done the same for us. He's the beloved Son in whom God is well pleased, and God will accept that life of righteousness. Through faith, you could be accepted through him. You know, sometimes we come to the Gospels and we think of it only as, well, Jesus died for us and rose again for us, and while that's true, don't miss that he didn't just die under the burden of sin in our place. He lived the life of righteousness in our place.